Welcome to the My Buddy Green podcast. I'm Jason Wachob, founder and co-CEO of My Buddy Green, and your host. If you're a regular listener, you know I am obsessed with coffee. My love affair with coffee started over 25 years ago. I drink it daily, I drink it early, and I drink it often. On a typical day, I'll have around 5 to 6 cups. Now, if I'm going to drink so much of something, I want to feel confident that it's good for my health. So you can imagine how freaked out I was when I found out that many coffee beans actually contain mold and microscopic toxins. Mold can form on coffee beans when they are grown, stored, or transferred in a moist, warm environment, and the supply chain of coffee makes it particularly susceptible to mold and the toxic chemicals called mycotoxins. According to some analysis, up to 50% of beans tested positive for mycotoxins, which can cause serious liver and kidney issues in high doses. Mycotoxins are almost impossible to see or taste, unlike the mold you might see from water damage in your house. And the effect that mycotoxin exposure has on humans isn't entirely clear, and there's a level of uncertainty that I, as a coffee lover, am just not comfortable with. I believe in compromise, but not when it comes to what I'm putting into my body. When I drink something so often, I want to know that I'm giving myself all the best possible benefits and not ingesting anything that is going to potentially negate all the other good stuff I'm doing. And once I learned about all the bad stuff like mold, mycotoxins, and other contaminants in coffee, I knew it was time to work on a better product. And I started asking myself the following questions. Would it be possible to source a USDA certified organic coffee that was high in polyphenols and had no mold, mycotoxins, pesticides, and heavy metals? And would we be able to test for all of the above? Could we find a coffee that meets all of our aforementioned standards and actually tastes great? No one wants to drink healthy coffee that tastes like crap. We want it to taste good. It took over a year, but we found a solution that delivers in full. Clean Coffee Plus. Our brand new coffee is handled in a way that reduces the risk of fungal growth and is rigorously tested for mold and mycotoxins, along with other nasties like pesticides and heavy metals. The testing that we do gives me confidence that the product I am drinking multiple times a day has nothing to hide. We test for an exhaustive battery of contaminants, 4 heavy metals, 10 microbial tests, 21 mycotoxins, 300 plus pesticides, and 20 solvents. I absolutely love our new Clean Coffee Plus, and I know you will too. So go to shop.mindbuddygreen.com/coffee20 to get 20% off your first order. You are going to love this coffee, and I really hope you try it. There is so much nutrition information out there. You can name every fad diet under the sun, and yet we don't actually have a set definition for quote-unquote nutrient dense. That's why Dr. Sarah Ballantyne came up with a new approach called Nutrivore. It's a diet predominantly composed of nutrient-dense whole foods. She calculates all the nutrients our bodies need from the foods we eat, gives each food a score based on its scientific literature, and it's a sustainable, easy to follow, and fascinating approach to nutrition. And I was so surprised by some of the highest scoring foods, including one of my favorites, coffee. Now, Sarah is a medical biophysicist and a New York Times bestselling author of 4 books. And yes, her latest must read is called Nutrivore, and it explains exactly how to get the most nutritional bang for your buck with every meal. This is a really interesting and fun episode. So what are some of the myths you used to believe, but have changed your views on?
I think the quintessential example is my views on vegetable oils. So this is both how we read the science, but also how the science has really changed the landscape of what even like medical professionals think about vegetable oils. So we used to look at vegetable oils as being high omega-6 polyunsaturated fats. And we used to say, okay, well, we don't want too many omega-6s because those contribute to inflammatory pathways. We want to balance those with omega-3s, which is what we get from seafood because those contribute to anti-inflammatory pathways. And we understand that in the cell, what makes the difference between an inflammatory pathway and an anti-inflammatory pathway is whether or not there's omega-6s or omega-3s there to get turned into the molecules that are responsible for all of the signaling. And so we used to think, okay, if you're eating a ton of vegetable oils, those are high in linoleic acid, the, you know, simplest omega-6. So they must be inflammatory. We see this in animals. We see this in cell culture studies. And over the last 5-ish years, we've had more and more human studies that show, well, in humans, that's not actually happening. Actually, we're seeing that higher vegetable oil consumption lowers cardiovascular disease risk, that it has a sort of neutral effect on inflammation. And we don't really understand why. We can just see this, like, really now, after so many studies, large body of scientific evidence showing vegetable oils are overall beneficial. And that means there must be some kind of regulation of these inflammatory and anti-inflammatory pathways that are not just which fat happens to be in the cell membrane, which is fascinating. But I think that, me changing my stance on that was requiring me to be open to these new studies that challenged a really deeply held belief that was also based in a huge wealth of scientific studies. So I think that is, like, my best example of some way that I've really shifted gears.
Talk about best example. That may be given. I'm going to commend you for changing your view. And I'm not going to say I agree or disagree, but I think it's a huge deal that you actually, one, changed your view, because very few people in this space do. And I think it's even a bigger deal given how you're known in some circles as the paleo mom. Like, this is how you built your personal brand. And within the paleo community, I would say there's probably consensus that, you know, seed oils are evil and you should avoid them at all costs. And I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with your view or their view. I think it's very nuanced, but I think that's incredible that you actually changed your view. And that is a hot topic. That is a big one.
I mean, I think you're right that in sort of the wellness community at large, it's more common for people to double down on their views than it is to shift. But I think that one of the things that makes me different in this space is that I have a background in medical research, that I used to be in the lab doing these experiments, trying to expand human knowledge. And if I am not a person who can follow the science and change my views when the science challenges them and forces me to say, oh no, like, look, all of these old studies in mice don't actually apply. The studies in humans are showing something different. Fascinating. If I can't follow that, then what's my value as a science communicator in this space?
100% agree. I wish more people were like you in that regard.
So do I.
So on the subject of linoleic acid specifically, so are you okay with linoleic acid across the board? Because some will criticize in our space, you know, peanuts and other foods high in linoleic acid. So can we just talk about linoleic specifically?
Yeah. So the studies that look at linoleic acid and its role in the most studied is, like, its role in cardiovascular disease, because that's what we were the most concerned about. Now that we've been able to separate out the effects of linoleic acid versus trans fats, because they're now, we're phasing out trans fats, they're not now in different products. Scientific studies measure this in two ways. So one, they do, like, diet recalls where they look at how much linoleic acid rich foods somebody is eating. But the more accurate measurement is tissue levels of linoleic acid. And this has also been done in very, very large studies and show that overall, the higher your linoleic acid consumption, up to about 10% of calories, which is a lot, risk of cardiovascular disease continues to decrease. And I think that body of scientific literature has made me go, I mean, we want to be moderating fat overall, like, we want to be eating a diverse and balanced diet, but there doesn't seem to be a compelling rationale based on the science from the last 5 years to limit linoleic acid, other than if it's getting to be 10% of calories, that's where we start to see a kind of a cap of benefit.
To get to 10% of calories, that's, like, kind of insane consumption.
Especially when you think that total fat consumption should be in the 20 to 30 5% range probably for most of us. So if half of your fat was linoleic acid, that would be that would be a lot. You'd be missing out on the benefits of monounsaturated fats like oleic acid or omega-3 fats in that case.
And on the subject of fats, and this one I made the mistake myself, I'll just share with the audience. I was trying to get more fat in my diet, and I tend to try to avoid seed oils. I go out to eat, they're going to happen because most restaurants use seed oils. So like, I'll try to avoid it at home, but I go out to eat, I'm having seed oils. I can live with that. But anyway, I was trying to get more fat in my diet, and I was doing a little bit of an experiment, and I started consuming a lot more coconut milk. And I, for some reason, did not make the connection that coconut milk is essentially the same as coconut oil. If you look at the amount of saturated fat, and coconut oil always had like a watch out in my brain in terms of like overconsumption, bad for your lipid profile. And I believe it's a C16 fatty acid, which overconsumption. So I'm like doing my experiment, tried to get a little bit more fat in my diet. And I do regular extensive blood work. And my lipid panel went like bananas, like in a way.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm like, oh, wait. Ah, I should have realized this. And like where I'm going, it's like the conversation around oil specifically. And this is on both sides of the paleo and the vegan community. Like, you got to be careful. And that's like my watch out to people. And with regards, bringing it back to CBD, cardiovascular disease is still the number one killer in America.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting about coconut oil is that the science is at lower levels of consumption, right? So in the 5 to 10% of calories range, it seems to be overall beneficial. It doesn't seem to be have as big of an effect on lipid profiles as other sources of saturated fat like butter. But once you get above that 10% calories from saturated fat, it doesn't seem to matter if the saturated fat's coming from plants or animal foods. Above 10%, we start to see that increased risk of cardiovascular disease.
There you go. It doesn't matter if it's coming from plants or animals. And then this is where the nuance lies, and also personalized medicine. I'm also, what I've learned in this process is like I'm a hyper absorber of sat fat. So like I'm actually better off eating a lean cut of meat, which is 100% animal food, versus a vegetarian dish soaked in coconut oil or whatever it may be. And so there lies the nuance, at which most people don't get, but you do. So building off of that, the bigger question, you know, your background is in cardiovascular health. So, you know, I know it's hard to generalize, but like what are like your macro views on how one should eat for their cardiovascular health?
I really like to focus on foods we can add rather than foods that we can take away. Because my view on how our foods impact our health is very much through the lens of, are the foods we're eating actually supplying our body with the nutritional resources that our body needs to be healthy? And there's a couple dozen nutrients that the cardiovascular system requires in order to just function normally. So if you're short on any one, or worse, a handful of those, it puts strain on the cardiovascular system, which can, over time, interact with lifestyle factors like high stress or not enough sleep or inactivity, interact with genetics, interact with environmental factors to increase our risk of heart attack, stroke, deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, whatever it is. So the foods that help to provide the nutrients that our cardiovascular system needs, that have the biggest impact on cardiovascular disease incidence and mortality risk, are eating a lot of vegetables. Studies kind of show 3 to 5 servings per day of vegetables maximally reduces risk of cardiovascular disease. Nuts and seeds, 1 serving per day. Nuts, seeds, and peanuts, 1 ounce per day, has some of the biggest reductions in cardiovascular disease risk of any food. Legumes, which are sometimes weirdly in studies lumped up with nuts and seeds, so sometimes they look at them together, but pulse-type legumes like lentils and chickpeas have some of the biggest reductions in cardiovascular disease incidence and mortality. And seafood, fish and shellfish because of those long chain omega-3s and how important they are for membrane fluidity, which is really important for elasticity of our vasculature.
So you mentioned legumes, you mentioned nuts and seeds, and another hot topic or hot button area is anti-nutrients, specifically foods high in phytic acid or oxalates. And a lot of those foods in those three categories are considered among some to be, well, anti-nutrients, either high in phytic acid or oxalates. What's your view on those?
I think anti-nutrients are often portrayed as as something that can leach nutrients from our bodies, which is not what they actually are. They are like phytates and oxalates, right? They are salts with a mineral. So calcium oxalate, right, being the zinc phytate, they are complexed with a mineral, and they reduce absorption of that mineral, but they can't actually sap the minerals from our body or even stop the absorption of other minerals in that food or other minerals that we eat in the same meal. So we really only worry about phytates and oxalates when, for example, vegetarians and vegans do need a little bit more dietary zinc, because most of the zinc in a vegetarian or vegan diet is in a phytate complex. But most of the time, we can rely on our amazing gut bacteria to metabolize those for us. We have bacteria that their preferred food is phytates or their preferred food is oxalates. And they can actually, a healthy gut microbiome can actually process most of the phytates and oxalates in the average human diet, which is why, again and again, those high phytate, high oxalate foods show up as protective, lowering risk of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, cancer, chronic kidney disease. Like, we wouldn't see those benefits in the medical literature if the anti-nutrients were as a big a deal as some people say.
So they're not leaching, they're not stealing the minerals from your body. Essentially, you're just going to absorb somewhat, something has 10, slightly less. If it is 10 milligrams, I'm making this up, maybe absorb 7.
Yes, exactly.
So on the subject of deficiencies, what do you think most people are walking around with and unaware of?
So that's a really good question. The studies that have looked at true deficiency. So let's take a vocab moment to talk about the difference between deficiency and insufficiency. So deficiency means that our intake of those nutrients is so low that it causes a disease of malnutrition. Right. So scurvy from vitamin C deficiency, or rickets from vitamin D deficiency. And diseases of malnutrition in Western countries are very rare because we have all of our most affordable food is fortified or enriched. Right. So that actually, those programs were put in place to address diseases of malnutrition. So actually, what's more common than something like scurvy would be something like iron deficiency anemia. So some of the diseases of malnutrition that don't have like as overt symptoms that would have you go to a doctor and get a diagnosis, right? Anemia typically presents as amorphous fatigue, maybe being out of breath. And those are things that you can easily wave off to, oh yeah, I haven't been to the gym for a while and I didn't get a good night's sleep last night. So it's one of those ones that people aren't as quick to go seek medical help as my teeth are falling out and my gums are bleeding from scurvy, or my child's legs are bowed from rickets. So in terms of true deficiency, overall, it's typically seen in food insecure households, right? In people who in gross malnourishment is typically where we're seeing it in Western countries. Insufficiency is that whole space in between the minimum level I need to avoid the disease of deficiency and actually meeting my nutritional needs. So for example, for vitamin C, you only need 10 milligrams per day to prevent scurvy. But the recommended dietary intake is 75 milligrams for adult females and 90 milligrams for adult males. The space of insufficiency is between that 10 milligrams and 75 or 90. And living in that space increases risk of, for vitamin C, it would be like cardiovascular disease, a few forms of cancer, cataracts, age-related macular degeneration, gout, conditions like that. So with insufficiency, the most common ones, there's so many studies that measure this that actually look at either blood levels, if you're talking about something that is not every nutrient in our blood is sensitive to how much is in our diet, because sometimes nutrients in our blood are regulated by cool organs like our kidneys, but also looking at, you know, diet, sort of like dietary journals and looking at intake levels. So the most common ones there are potassium is the most. So almost 98% of us are living in that insufficiency world for potassium. Folate, vitamin A, vitamin K, and vitamin E. Those are like the most common ones. And together between those, you kind of have every chronic illness that is on the rise is covered.
So you also mentioned fortified and enriched foods. My head goes straight to grains, specifically bread, because a lot of bread, if you're buying a bread and it's not certified organic, it's probably going to be fortified or enriched wheat flour, anything you see it on the label. What's your view on fortified and enriched foods?
There are a few success stories for fortified foods, right? So if you think about the first fortified food was iodized table salt in the 1920-ish. And then the fortification of grains with B vitamins and iron, that those programs started in the 40s. And they started at a time where diseases of malnutrition like beriberi or pellagra, vitamin B1 and vitamin B3 deficiency, were much more common, right? We had a goiter belt in America, which was an area where the iodine content in the soil was so low that there wasn't iodine for the plants to uptake. So there wasn't iodine for the animal feed. So there wasn't enough iodine in the food. And people were having, you know, this big enlargement of the thyroid gland in the neck due to iodine deficiency. So the three main success stories are of fortified foods is like a 74-ish, if I remember correctly, percent reduction in risk of goiter, 30-ish percent reduction in the risk of iron deficiency anemia. And I can't remember exactly, but a very substantial reduction in the risk of birth defects due to folate deficiency.
I want to stay on the bread piece. So on the subject of pellagra, what's interesting is we fortified our way out of it in the U.S. because it was killing people. And we acted quickly and fortified foods entered the equation. And in Italy, I believe it was like Southern Italy, they kind of like did the Italian way and they did these, I want to say, like group like ovens in the community where they like bake sourdough bread. And it took a little bit longer, but they also eradicated the disease eventually. It's because it's a niacin deficiency, I believe.
Yes.
And sourdough bread is rich in niacin. So like they sourdoughed their way out of this. It took a little bit longer, which brings me to bread. I love a good slice of sourdough, a good organic slice of sourdough. What's your view on grains, more specifically bread? And we have to touch on sourdough.
So I will say broadly, I think whole grains can be an excellent food for an excellent affordable food. Let's make sure that affordability is part of this equation to help people meet their fiber needs. But if I compare the health impacts of whole grains to, say, the health impacts of legumes, which are even more fiber dense and also much more nutrient dense overall, legumes just have a much more profound benefit. I would call whole grains a food to round out a balanced diet with, rather than one of the foods to base a balanced diet on, if that makes any sense.
Well said. So zooming out, the book is fantastic. It's called Nutrivore. I encourage everyone to pick it up. I think it's one of the most innovative books we've seen in a while. And what I love is you come up with this Nutrivore score, because myself included, all of our listeners, you know, people want to know, like, what should I eat? What should I go shopping for? And I think most people buy into what you're saying. It's not about, you know, deleting or editing. It's about adding the right foods. And so let's just start by talking about the concept of Nutrivore and how you came up with the score. And then we'll kind of chip away at some of my favorite food groups and foods again.
Oh, fun. Okay. So Nutrivore as a concept is like the evolution of my nerdiness about nutrient density. And it came from wanting to look at what health-promoting diets have in common. And what they have in common is they tend to focus on the most nutrient-dense foods, right? Things like vegetables and seafood. Many incorporate organ meat, for example. And so in my search to understand how do we actually get all of the nutrients our bodies need. That was the origin of creating an entire dietary philosophy around that simple goal. So Nutrivore is not a specific diet. It is simply a nutritional sciences education to help us understand how to choose different foods compatible with our preferred diets in such a way to actually get all of the nutrients our bodies need from the foods we eat. And achieving that goal requires a little bit of like understanding what nutrients do in the body and what foods have what nutrients, but also it required a quantification of nutrient density. And I think in the wellness community for a couple of decades, we've been throwing out this word nutrient dense a lot without having an agreed upon definition or any kind of consistent way to identify nutrient dense foods. So I started when I was first conceptualizing Nutrivore, I started by reading just about every study ever done in the field of nutrient profiling, which is the science of categorizing foods according to the nutrients they contain. And since the early 2000s, nutrient density has been defined by big agencies as a food that contains a lot of nutrients per calorie. And what scientists have done is they've created a couple dozen different nutrient density scores that try to quantify that. But what I ran into as I was trying to, like, my initial intention was to pick a nutrient density score that's already established in the scientific literature and use the work that someone else has done. And I kept hitting upon this wall where the way that field of research is going right now is they're trying to figure out the fewest number of nutrients to put into a calculation so that the numbers they get at the end align with the healthy eating index, which is a measurement of how well somebody's diet aligns with the dietary guidelines for Americans, the USDA dietary guidelines, which is, in my mind, backwards. I want to understand what nutrients a food contains and then see if that alters dietary guidelines. And to me, the best way to understand what nutrients a food contains is to have as many different inputs into that calculation as possible. Instead of trying to figure out what five or six nutrients best give me a score that best aligns with some dietary template, I want to understand the nutrient density of that food, and then I'll figure out the dietary template on the other side of that. And so what I ended up doing was devising the Nutrivore score. It is still based on this field of scientific literature. It's still algorithmically identical to something called the Nutrient-Rich Foods Index. But instead of a handful of inputs, there's 33 inputs, which basically just about every nutrient that had sufficient data to make its inclusion in the calculation make sense. And then all of the calculations I did blind, and then I just learned from them. And that has informed a lot of the sort of Nutrivore recommendations that I make in my book and on my website over time.
It's very comprehensive. And I also loved the food that gets, or excuse me, it's not a food, but the highest score, coffee.
Yes. One of the highest scores.
So it's, one of the highest scores, coffee. I love coffee. We have an organic coffee. It's right behind me. I love a good black coffee. I drink it daily. So let's talk about, let's start with that. This is such a great interview because we're starting with the fun stuff. Coffee. Tell us more.
So coffee earns its very high Nutrivore score thanks to being such a concentrated source of polyphenols and for only 2 calories per cup if you're drinking it black. So it has the benefit of having a huge amount of nutrients, also has quite a lot of biotin and vitamin B2. I don't think people realize they're getting B vitamins from a cup of coffee. A little bit of fiber too. I mean, how cool. I mean, coffee, objectively the best. But it has this super high concentration of polyphenols, which we also know from a variety of scientific studies is one of the main reasons why coffee keeps turning up again and again as protective, all in a very low calorie package. So in order for a food to have a high Nutrivore score, it has to have a lot of nutrients for each calorie. So a high calorie food, right? Something like liver is also a very high Nutrivore score food, but it has 11 nutrients where it's delivering over 60% of the daily value in a 3-ounce serving. So even though it has more calories, you know, it's just packed with nutrients. Low calorie foods like coffee or other really high Nutrivore score foods like watercress or Swiss chard, they don't need to have as many nutrients because they're lower calories. So that denominator being so low means that coffee having, about almost double the ideal amount of polyphenols in a single cup. So it's super, super amazing on the polyphenols. 20-ish, I think, if I remember correctly, percent of the daily value of biotin, 10-ish percent of vitamin B2, all for 2 calories. That's the type of food that the more of those foods are in our diet, the easier it is to meet our nutritional needs and have lots of calories to spare at the end of the day for whatever we want.
I love it. I just want to end the interview now, but we have to keep going. So you touched on vegetables. You mentioned watercress. What I'm going to do is kind of go food group and maybe just share a favorite or that achieved a high score. So the next one on my list would be fruits.
The highest scoring fruit of like common to find options in the grocery store. There's lots of tropical fruit that have high scores that you're never going to get your hands on. The highest scoring fruit is strawberries. So first of all, blueberries have the best PR team of all the fruit, right? And I would have guessed in a million years based on all of the stories and the news about how great blueberries are. They are great. There's lots of science showing that blueberries are great. I'm not saying blueberries are bad, but strawberries have almost double the nutrient density of blueberries. And most studies that evaluate the benefits of berries look at all culinary berries. Botanical berries is a different thing. So strawberries, they're the standout. They have a Nutri-Score of 762, if I remember correctly. Like top fruit of common ones you can find in the grocery store.
Love it. What about legumes?
So legumes, I think lentils are the big standout. Legumes in general, actually, to take a higher level of view, legumes are the most nutrient-dense starchy food. Which was a surprise to me. I would have thought starchy root vegetables like sweet potatoes would beat out legumes. There are some really nutrient-dense root vegetables, and winter squash tends to be really nutrient-dense. But on average, legumes are more so. They're just packed with minerals and vitamins. They tend to be really high in polyphenols. And lentils are probably king in the legume world.
And okay, we have as a family, it's lentil pasta with the only ingredient is lentils. That okay or am I?
That's my favorite too.
Love it. Love the tolerance.
That is my preferred way to eat legumes is in pasta form.
Yeah, we buy the tolerant pasta. It's clean label. Amazing. Seafood.
Oysters is the top. So Eastern oysters, I think, have a Nutri-Score of 3,049. So it's pretty hard. Actually, oysters are about the same as liver in terms of nutrient density, which, again, I would never have guessed without doing the math.
I remember seeing this, and I was surprised that sardines weren't higher. They were like the middle of the pack, if I recall, in seafood.
They're kind of in the middle. They're still triple the nutrient density of a chicken, boneless, skinless chicken breast. So they're still like an incredibly valuable protein food. Like all seafood trumps muscle meat. And shellfish is about the same as organ meat. So sardines are still amazing. One of the reasons why it's kind of hard to predict the Nutri-Score of a food when you just look at the like nutrition facts label, even if you have a really detailed nutrition facts table from the USDA Food Central database, for example, is it's kind of hard to intuit how all of these nutrients are going to add up and then how it's going to divide by the energy density of the food. So when you have a higher energy density food, which sardines are because they're higher fat content, that's what kind of brings down the score compared to something like crab or mussels or clams, which have more nutrients, but also a lower energy density.
So often in the functional medicine community, you'll hear SMASH, sardines, mackerel, anchovies, salmon, and herring. Does that still hold up for you? It sounds like I'm hearing you really can't go wrong with seafood.
Yes, that is, I would say whatever seafood you like, have access to and can afford is the seafood to eat. What's so great about the SMASH acronym is those are all fatty fish, right? So they're all ones that are really high omega-3s. Docosahexaenoic acid and eicosapentaenoic acid are two long-chain omega-3s that are so important for neurological health, cardiovascular health, and immune health. Those omega-3s, our best sources are fatty fish. So I'm all on board.
Sardines are reasonable and portable. They're shelf stable. They're a couple, $4 or $5. You get a great brand of sardines and they're nutrient dense and you can bring it anywhere. Your partner may not like you. You know, sardines everywhere, but they're great. What about meat?
So putting organ, like I feel like organ meat, we already kind of talked about organ meat's in a separate box. And I feel like organ meat is not as accessible, like actual people can find it in their grocery stores or flavor accessible for a lot of people.
Just on that note, sorry to interrupt. So like with organ meat, I'll try everything. I'm health forward. I'll do the crazy test. I just can't do organ meat. I won't do it. I genuinely really love meat. I don't eat as much as I used to, but like, I just can't do it.
I do enjoy a steak and kidney pie, I have to say. And maybe that's my upbringing because I grew up in a house where we had liver and onions every Sunday. But I also, on the subject of organ meat, I think it's okay to hide it from yourself, right? So there's all these different like organ meat, ground meat blends that you can get, or you can make your own. And then you can make your tacos or your hamburgers depending on the blend. And I think there's lots of ways that we can incorporate into our diets that isn't painful.
That's a great call. Force of Nature. The brand, they're great people, they're friends, they have an ancestral blend. And that's how I kind of, there's like a little liver in that. That's a great call. But organ meat by itself, personally, I can't do. But sorry to interrupt, please go on about meat.
About meat in general. So the meat that's, all of the meats that are the most nutrient density are all the game meats. So it's venison, bison, elk, rabbit, those, emu. So even if they're farmed, right, you farm venison quite differently than how you farm beef. All of those game meats tend to be the most nutrient dense. They have higher nutrients and they tend to be leaner, which is how they get higher nutrient density.
Venison, another caveat, the Maui Nui venison sticks, I can do. I don't know if you've ever tried those.
I have. I've had my uncle hunted as a kid. And so he would just come out of the mountains and fill the freezer with bear or caribou or elk. And I always liked it when it was venison because, especially compared to bear, it was much, much, much more flavorful. Bear's a lot.
But staying on meat, it sounds like chicken's overrated here.
It's fine. Eggs are actually slightly more nutrient dense than chicken, which is kind of a fascinating thing to say. So generally, like the leaner cuts of meat are more nutrient dense, which sort of aligns with Mediterranean diet style principles. Chicken's kind of middle of the pack. Your fattier cuts of pork or beef are less nutrient dense than chicken. Yeah, it's fine. But if you can swap out chicken for seafood, you're going to win.
And what about another hot topic, dairy?
So of all of the foods, one of the biggest surprises to me was how low nutrient density cheese is. And in part because cheese is the most concentrated food source of calcium. So like we don't find calcium per gram or calcium per calorie as high in other foods. And yet most cheeses kind of average out a Nutri score of like 140, which is compared to our strawberries for 762. Chicken is going to be in the 250 range. Salmon's going to be in the 700 to 900 range. So to end up at 140, it doesn't mean it doesn't have like a nutritional role to play because of its calcium, but nutritionally overall, pretty underwhelming.
What about yogurt? What about milk?
Interestingly, the lower fat, so skim milk, yogurt, or milk has a higher Nutri-Score score than a like whole fat version, although the differences aren't huge. And they're definitely scoring higher than cheese. They're in the, you know, 200 to 300 range compared to 140, but generally still, I guess, in that same range as like an 80-20 ground beef.
Interesting. So on the subject of milk, a lot of people make smoothies, myself included, and you've got options there. You've got your milk, let's call it a grass-fed milk. You've got your almond milk. You've got your oat milk. You've got your cashew milk. You've got your walnut milk. You've got your macadamia. You can go on and on with the alternative milks. Do you have a view? If we're going to make a smoothie and we're going to use a dairy milk or an alternative milk, what do you think?
So grass-fed dairy does have a really special fat in it called conjugated linoleic acid, which has lots of health benefits. And you get 4 to 5 times more in the grass-fed version compared to the conventional version for both meat and dairy. And it does have lots of benefits. We do see slightly higher scores in grass-fed meat compared to conventional. Whether or not that's worth the price differential, I feel like, is an individual choice. And there are some small cardiovascular benefits to dairy. And certainly when you're talking about children, there are some growth benefits to dairy. In terms of environmental impact, you know, it's hard to beat oat milk. In terms of, you know, nuts and seeds are still very beneficial. So you're still getting a really beneficial milk if you're choosing almond milk or cashew milk. So I feel like I can make a case for any of them.
Have at it. It's your choice.
Yeah. Choose the one, again, that you like, have access to, and can afford, and that makes the best smoothie.
Well said. Closing the loop on grains. Is there a specific grain that scored well?
Yeah. Bulgur.
Bulgur.
Yes. I never would have guessed this in a million years. Bulgur and the pseudo grains, like buckwheat and amaranth, are the highest NutriVerScore grains. And why bulgur is so much higher than something like, well, I mean, it's because you're not, you're really eating the whole grain. You're not removing anything. And because the nutrients tend to be concentrated in the germ and the hull, as soon as you start doing any kind of processing of grains, you're removing some nutrients. So I think that's why bulgur is so high.
Interesting. So another fun one, perhaps the most fun, sweeteners. Let's talk about sweeteners. What did you find there?
So the two biggest surprises of sweeteners are maple syrup and molasses. So maple syrup ends up with a NutriScore around 100. Remember, cheese is 140. 100 is not that much less, largely thanks to its minerals. Maple syrup is very high in manganese. But molasses is king. 349, I think. I don't know why these numbers stick in my head.
Wow, triple.
You know, when you're making sugar, you're boiling down the sugar cane or sugar beets to extract the sugar crystals. And what's left over at the end is the molasses, whether it's beet molasses or cane molasses. I don't have very complete nutrition data for beet molasses, but I do for cane molasses. And so you're concentrating the vitamins, you're concentrating the minerals. Regular old cane molasses has more calcium per calorie than cheese and more iron per calorie than steak. I like a lot more. And so I'm one of the best food sources of potassium, the nutrient that almost 98% of us aren't getting enough of.
Molasses has iron. I never would have guessed that. Iron. What about honey? A lot of people love honey.
So honey is one of the bigger sadness disappointments in the NutriScore calculation. I will say, so honey has a NutriScore of 20 or 21, but I will say that honey...
That's like the lowest we've talked about.
Yeah. White sugar has one. It's around the same as brown sugar or turbinado sugar. But I will say that honey has non-nutritive compounds that are beneficial. So it has things, right, like a pollen in it that we know can help alleviate allergies. It has some cool, like, triterpenes, like phytonutrients that we don't have really good data on, so we can't include it in the NutriVerScore. So in terms of, like, vitamins and minerals and polyphenols per calorie, it doesn't stand out. But there is quite a lot of mostly small studies showing that honey has anti-diabetic effects. You know, we do have other studies showing that honey is overall a really healthy choice for a sweetener, which I think is a really great opportunity to kind of talk about NutriVore as a dietary philosophy being so much more than just always choosing the highest NutriVerScore food. Like, the NutriVerScore is a fascinating lens through which to view food. It tells us a lot, but it doesn't tell us everything. And honey is a great sort of case in point.
And what about chocolate?
Chocolate also reduces diabetes risk thanks to its chromium and polyphenols, which is my favorite fun fact about chocolate. The darker the chocolate, the higher the NutriVerScore. Cocoa powder has a NutriVerScore of like 1,036, something like that. It's incredibly high thanks to its polyphenols. It has really high minerals. It's quite very high fiber as well. So the darker the chocolate, the better in terms of nutrient density. But chocolate actually has a lot of valuable nutrition.
You made a lot of people happy alongside us coffee lovers. Coffee and chocolate, what a wonderful combo. One where I think we all know the answer to, but I'd be remiss not to ask, alcohol.
Yeah, sadly, most like distilled spirits basically have a NutriScore of 0 to 1 or 2. You distill out all the nutrients when you concentrate the alcohol. Wine ends up in the 60 to 100 range. It's actually kind of sad.
That's not bad. That's like up there with cheese.
It's not that far from cheese. I feel like that there's a motto in there somewhere, like a t-shirt, like it's not that different from cheese. Yeah. But if you compare it to something like orange juice with a Nutri-Score of 300-ish, that's when you start to see that nutritionally it doesn't have as much to offer.
Right. So how should people think about the Nutrivore score? And everyone go buy the book and look at the scores, and it's beyond the scores. It's just a wealth of info. How would you like people to take this information and run with it? What's your vision?
So definitely not gamification. Like definitely not trying to figure out like how I can maximize my Nutrivore score for the day, because that I think takes away from enjoyment of food. And I think enjoying the food we're eating is a really important part of sustainable eating habits. Two, the most important dietary patterns overall are high dietary diversity, meaning we're eating a wide variety of different foods, that we're eating mostly whole foods, and that we're eating a higher abundance of plant foods compared to animal foods. And I think that we can get so wrapped up in the number that it can take away from those big overarching themes in terms of long-term eating patterns. So the way I recommend using the Nutrivore score is to look at the components of your meal and where you can swap something out for something that has higher nutrient density. So if you were going to serve your chicken and salad tonight with a dinner roll, your dinner roll is going to have a Nutrivore score around 130. But you could swap that out for a baked potato. Now you've got a Nutrivore score around 270-ish. Or you could swap that out for a baked sweet potato. Now you've got a Nutrivore score around 370-ish. Or you could swap that out for butternut squash. Now you've got a Nutrivore score in the 700s. So that's where like understanding the nutrient density and thinking of those like simple swaps that can up the nutrient value of that meal, that's where the Nutrivore score is really, really helpful.
What are some of the swaps you've incorporated in your personal life that you found to be meaningful?
So one of the biggest swaps was swapping out rice noodles, because I have celiac, so wheat pasta is not on the table for me. Swapping out rice noodles for lentil noodles, that is approximately nearly 8 to 10 times more nutrient dense. It's sort of hard to know how much the processing impacts the nutrients because we don't have complete data of the finished noodle, but we do have complete data of the materials that are going into the noodle. I think that was a big one. And I think the other big thing for me is a daily salad. Like it's not a swap so much as like an addition. So either lunch or dinner, I have a big salad every single day. And that is just packed with like all of the most nutrient dense foods. So I would say those are the two biggest changes in my life is adding in more lentils in pasta form preferred, and making sure to always have salad every day.
And do you have any views on how we should be thinking about macros for our meals?
The easiest way to get all of our micronutrients, so all of the vitamins, minerals, phytonutrients, essential amino acids, essential fatty acids, is with balanced macronutrients, which means falling within the accepted macronutrient distribution ranges. So that is 10 to 30% protein, 10 to 35% fat, and 45 to 65% carbs. So falling within those ranges, that's the actual definition of a balanced diet. And part of how those ranges are set is considering how easy it is to get micronutrients with different macronutrient breakdowns. So because I power lift, I eat a little bit higher protein, and then moderate fat, moderate carbohydrates is how I personally choose to eat, because that supports recovery and performance. And that is a very easy way to make sure we're getting all of the vitamins and minerals we need.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned protein and lifting, because I think in that it's coming up on 14, 15 years I've been at this, I think that's the biggest shift we've seen in the space is protein consumption and resistance training has definitely picked up steam among women, more specifically women above 40. Not that it didn't exist before, but I think it is widely acknowledged that it is critical for women to maintain their muscle mass as their age. And I think it's also wonderful where we're embracing culturally women of all sizes. Women can be strong.
Yes.
can be powerful. And that's amazing. And I think the protein resistance conversation was one that's fairly new, but exciting. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
I couldn't agree more.
What else have you, you've been in the space for a while. What has you excited right now?
Beyond the upcoming release of my new book?
Obviously, besides your book, because I'm also going to ask, what are you not so excited about as well? Because I've seen, so we'll start with the positive.
So one of the things that I'm seeing on my social media is this growing community of people who are resonating with positive messages. So a typical post for me would be, if iceberg lettuce is your favorite lettuce, guess what? It's more nutrient dense than artichoke, celery, or cucumber. It's a very nutrient dense choice. It's not as nutrient dense as other lettuces, but it's still valuable. And don't listen to people telling you it's the nutritional equivalent of cardboard. That's factually incorrect. It's not just crunchy water. It has lots of valuable nutrition. And that type of messaging, you know, it's fairly unusual in the wellness community. There's a lot more fear-mongering out there than there is positive messaging. But I would say, like, my most popular content is, here's all the reasons you can feel good about this food that you already enjoy and eat regularly. And I think what's so exciting to me, seeing that type of message resonate, is to me, it represents this swing of the, like, diet culture pendulum from restriction, 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 which I think has been the direction we've been going, especially the last 20 or 30 years, towards permission, permission, permission. And I frame Nutrivore as a permissive approach rather than a restrictive one. It's very much focused on the things we can add to our diets that improve our health rather than anything to take away. I do that because it's based on the psychology research, looking at long-term eating patterns and what's most sustainable rather than a thing that you do to achieve some kind of short-term goal and then you stop doing it once you've achieved that goal, which is the history of diets. So seeing this group of people so ready for this change, so ready to think positively about food again, instead of always thinking about what I shouldn't be eating, that to me is the most exciting. That shift in mindset and seeing that community grow, that's been my own personal journey over the last few years, and seeing other people on a similar trajectory is awesome.
Love the positive note. We don't have to do the negative then. We covered a lot today. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you would like to touch on, or any words of wisdom you'd like to leave our audience with before we go?
You know, the biggest thing is, as much as we have focused on sort of Nutrivore as a dietary philosophy and the Nutrivore score as a tool for making that easier, one of the things that I've done in my book is to really acknowledge the limits of how much health we can get from diet changes. So studies show that, like, diet plus lifestyle accounts for 40 to 50% of health outcomes. And I think it's a really empowering message, especially coming from the sort of therapeutic diet space, where if that's not enough to have miraculous health changes, we feel like it's our fault. And I think that one of the most important messages that I have to share with Nutrivore is 40 to 50% is huge. That is that's a very worthwhile percent to put effort into. But it also means that we can make diet and lifestyle choices and use the best of, you know, medicine, of what our doctors can offer us, of supplements. We get to kind of use the best of all worlds, and we get to have compassion for ourselves when we run into, and here's where the genetics kick in and the things that I have no control over, the social determinants of health. And I think that, you know, one of the most, I think it's empowering, is to understand that there's so much that improving diet quality can do for us, but it can't do everything. And we can let go of that idea that I didn't do it hard enough, and that's why I didn't have the success that I had. And instead, I think, appreciate how much I got from it. And I think that is that's the next mindset shift, I think, that we can all as a community start to embrace.
Love it. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.